Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everybody, welcome to Don't Make Me Come Back There. We are a funny podcast about family. My name is Dustin Nickerson. I'm a stand-up comedian and the host of the aforementioned podcast. And alongside me is Stephen English, also a stand-up comedian and the co-host the producer. In theory. Yeah. What are things that I've done more than stand-up comedy since I'm an internet I think I might be a content creator now. Yeah. Though you would not know it by my YouTube numbers. Here's where I'm big on all my videos do well on the places you can't get paid. So they do they do best on Instagram.
Right.
And then they do best on, and then after that, TikTok.
Right. Your MySpace is blowing up.
Huge on MySpace. But the only ones that you make money on are YouTube and Facebook, and those are my two worst. It's actually like embarrassing. I did that video, that Zac Efron video, and it has 25,000 views on Instagram, which is a lot for me.
Right.
And it has 110 on YouTube. Not 110,000, 110 total.
Right.
So,
right.
Anyways, thanks for tuning in, everybody. Thanks for checking out our little podcast. We really appreciate it. Today, our guest is stand-up comedian Bob Smiley, everybody. Make it loud for the Bob Smiley. Bob is a very funny stand-up comedian, and we had a nice chat. We talked a lot about... of course, all the comedians are just talking about comedy in its current state with us. He's a veteran. He's been at it for a long time. And so we talked about how he came up. He opened for concerts for some of his cut his teeth. And he did a lot of concerts and outdoor venues. And we talked about trials that comedy has gone through, for lack of a better word. This is dating him a bit, but he said Y2K was a bummer. Every election year was bad, and when the economy went bad, and 9/11 was bad for comedy. And I was like, yeah, see, this is just another one. And he's like, oh no, this is way worse than all of those.
Yeah.
So we talk about that. We talk about his home life right now with all the boys in the house and his wife and what they've been up to and all kinds of stuff with there and older kids. And, we're talking about the one kid who's college but just kind of comes and goes. And, we have a nice chat. And you can give, Bob a follow in all kinds of places. You can follow him on Twitter and Instagram at Bob Smiley Comic. And then he has two things I want to let you guys know. He has a drive-by comedy special, so you guys can check that out. And he too has a podcast, which is called Hook, Line, and Smiley. Ever wondered what would happen if you put two super opinionated, overly talkative, passionate, Jesus-loving people into a house, then add five boys, a dog, and some microphones? There you go. He wrote that, not me. I want to read you a comment real quick before we get to it. So this is today's edition of This week in the comments, I did this tweet which I thought was pretty funny. That Jesus taught outside. Jesus right. taught outside in the Middle East. Churches can wait a minute to reopen.
Sure.
Which I, you know, you put that on Twitter because I've put that on the book face or on you know, on the Instagram. It's going to turn into a whole thing. Twitter, you can like, I think there's more snark on Twitter. That people are just like, ah, he's just being snarky.
Right,
and if
right.
you put it on Facebook or Instagram, they're like, oh, no, he wants to
debate
this. He's
taking a stance. Yeah.
Yeah. The different platforms have a different feels to that.
Right.
And then this is one where someone said, so this is, okay. But as soon as we gather outside to worship, you're going to complain again that we're causing the spread because we can't social, quote, we can't social distance. We are in the end times, my friend, and I'm going to read this as it says. We are in the end times, my friend, and you're not a believe, so I don't know what they're trying to say there.
Sure, I'm trying.
Let's try this again. We are in the end times, my friend, and you're not a believe. I highly recommend you have a chat with Jesus tonight. You're going to need it. That sounds like a threat, doesn't it?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, real nice soul you what got you, there. Be a shame if it went to hell. You're like, wait, are you shaking me down? Are you trying to convert me by shaking me down? Yeah,
I know. Yeah, you're the one. You're the one threatening on Twitter, man. I just made a little snarky humor,
right.
Which was a thought that I had today when I was ready. Douchebag alert, golfing.
just tweet. Oh man, hot take. When hot just, take. Tweeting while you're golfing might be peak. Might be peak D-bag.
I didn't. For the record, I said it to the people I was golfing with: James Schrader, Dallas McLaughlin, and Jason Lawhead, all former front seaters.
Right.
I was like, oh, I got to remember to say that later. And right. you know, it's gotten like 10 retweets. So that's pretty big for me on Twitter. if you were to guess of those four, James Schrader, Dustin Nickerson, Jason Lawhead, Dallas McLaughlin, how would you rank them in order of golfers?
Oh, okay. Easy. Lawhead, number one. Lawhead probably is like a way better golfer than all three of the rest of you has put together. He just looks like he's been playing for a long time. Then okay. I'm going to say sneakily, I think you and Dallas are probably pretty close. I think you and Dallas are probably on the same level. And then I would say Schrader. Schrader seems like he goes golfing for the vibes.
For the vibes.
For the outdoor and just for the vibes. Like he has a good time.
He's more of a frisbee golfer, you would think.
He's a frolfer, yeah.
Some people, you look at them and you know they can chuck a disc.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't even want to see him on the Frolf course. I was trying to think of like a thing. I have no other reference.
You
for
know that
golf.
Guy. You know that guy has like. If we're like, hey, we're gonna go play this frisbee golf. He's gonna show up with several discs.
He's gonna have that guy. He's gonna have a headband. He's gonna be spinning the disc on one finger and he'll be like, so you guys want to put some money on this? You're like, nah, dude.
No, absolutely not. He throws it in waves you've never even seen a frisbee thrown.
Right, right.
Yeah. I would say, because I've gotten a lot better since we played.
Okay.
Jason, I would say Jason and I are about the same.
Okay.
He's probably, because technically I have a better score than him today. I shot an 87, no big deal. But the, you know what nobody ever cares about ever? Your golf score.
Yeah,
just there's no way.
Yeah.
Because unless you said like I shot a 72, I'd be like, oh my God.
Yeah, especially when your golf score starts with an 80 something, like nobody cares.
Exactly. Yeah. Nobody cares. Yeah.
You might as well say a billion jillion.
A billion jillion. Because if you watch somebody and who golfs and like, here's the thing, like a 97 and an 87 feel the same way if you're golfing with that person.
Right.
They don't, you know, like the difference of 10 shots, that's less than, you know, that's less than a shot per hole. So right. you don't even notice and you don't know what they're saying. A lot of time, you know, so Jason and I are comparable. And then James is actually a pretty good golfer. He hadn't played in a while. And Dallas is horrific. Dallas missed the ball
really?
Probably 20 times. Yeah, he's really bad. But he hadn't played in 2 years.
Okay.
And so I think he's, you know, he's got the bones. There's, you know, he's got some skill. But he came out... wearing the best polo. Yeah, he was wearing a Terribles polo. You know, Terribles, the old like gas station /casino.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I applaud him for that. But anyways, it's golf is one of those things. It's like one of the few things that we can do. And this is like you'll know this exact feeling because you have young kids. They were like, hey, so like we should do this like regularly, right? Like maybe we can do this again in a couple weeks. And I was like, oh no, like maybe this time next year we all come back and not even to golf, just 2021? To commemorate. Yeah, exactly. We're just going to like remember this day a year from now. I'm going to take a picture of this, put it in my Facebook memories just so I can remember that it happened. The idea that you would golf when you have like young kids often, like if I ever proposed that to Melissa, I was like, could I get like a monthly? She'd be like, I mean, that will work for because we'll be divorced and we'll be doing split custody at that point. No, and those are your weekends. You can do whatever you want.
You could do it. You just have to be out there at 5:30 in the morning. And I know for a fact you're not going to get up. Because you could, if you start at like 6, you'll be done by like 8. You know, you could be done pretty quickly. You'll be back home.
Yeah, those first round guys go pretty good.
You're not going to get up and be at the course at 6. You can't do a monthly noon 30 tea time. There's no way.
There's this guy that I play with. His name is Brian Dorfman. He owns a couple comedy clubs and he's a booker. Mm-hmm. And he golfs every day by himself. Like at like 6 in the morning.
Yeah.
And he plays in under 2 hours, you know, and he shoots in like the 70s. He's just by himself. And I was even worse then.
He's by himself. Like so who really knows what his real score is? He's saying.
And that's exactly true. He's by himself. No, I played with him and I can say he is if you play regularly, he's the most, he announces when the hole's over. like if you're like just like dinking around, he's like, he said at one point to one of the other guys, like, I cannot watch you chip over the green one more time. And so, like, he would be done. And then, like, maybe one other person would putt and he'd be like, all right, pick him up, boys. Like, he would just announce.
Right. Right.
Just the boldness of an alpha like that. Yeah. But your knee won't let you, right? You can't even get out there.
No, the last time I played was 2 Christmases ago, and I was barely. Remember, because the cart ran out of battery halfway up that big hill, and I had to walk up the hill, and I could barely make it.
Yeah.
I could barely make it up the hill.
Speaking of cart drama, I got in a head-on crash with another cart today, like both full speed, going like 10 miles per hour, which is like if you had an accident going 10 miles per hour in a car, it would be of significance. Like that's not slow enough. That's, you would get out and you would exchange. But this guy made this blind, like there's like a two-way, cart path. It was wide enough for 2. And it's where you would come in from 9 and when they would go out to 1 and they had a blind turn and they were hogging it on the wrong side of the road. And so I just blind turned.
Right. Did you ask him, was he Australian?
He was not Australian. Okay. We hit, and then Lawhead hit his head on the beam. And then another guy came out and was like, dude, what's your problem? To the other driver. And he's like, you just hit a wall like 5 minutes ago. just out here about to get a DUI in a golf cart or something.
Right, right.
The dude hit too many ultras in the clubhouse.
Yeah. Yeah, Mickey Ultra. That's funny. The only place I've ever seen Michelob Ultra being drank ever is like on a golf course. Yeah, because they're like
my dad fell in love with Michelob Ultras, and I remember he was just like they're light beers,
right?
And he's like, so I can have like 2 to 1. I was like, they're not that much lighter, Dad. Like you went from Bud Light to Michelob Ultra Light. They're not double. They're not half.
They're colored lighter, but they're the same amount of alcohol. There's less carbs, but they're still the same. Yeah, it's like this alcohol's the same.
And he would call them minis. And I was like, no, people don't call them mini. They're not smaller, Dad. Right. They're the same size.
Right. I track his logic, though. I like his logic. I like his logic because if you just make stuff up, everything's true. If you don't care about what's real, it's just everything can be true.
Well, you know, he would hit him hard at the lake house when we're down there. You know, tossing them horseshoes in the big family horseshoe tournament. Have I ever told you that was a thing our family did?
No, but horseshoes—that's fun. That's a fun time. That's actually like fun, and like it's everybody can actually play because like no one's great at horseshoes. There's people who are kind of good, and there's people who are kind of bad, but everyone's pretty much normal, and you just kind of have a good time with it. That's fun.
Exactly. We would do a family tournament each year.
Yeah.
And then we had like a trophy and you would get your name engraved on it. And your right. boy.
The trophy was just a 24-pack of Michelob Ultra.
Exactly. Of course. actually, a 48-pack. A 24-pack of a normal beer, 48-pack.
Because they're minis. Yeah, of course.
Because it's their minis. But the your boy had a bit of a dynasty in the. But
really?
It was so funny because my family is. Well, I was just, you know. I would get good at it, and I was young, so I would be the only like sober one by the end of the day.
Right, that's huge. That's huge, actually. Yeah,
it's huge. So I always thought of it like I just gotta get to the finals.
Right,
and there's a good chance that whatever, because we would pair them guy girl, but there were never enough girls. So the ultimate insult is if we're like, hey, Joe, you gotta be a girl this year. Because if you were so bad, you got this, like, but you'd be like, but that was your best chance of winning, though, would be to be a girl. Because, like, sure. You know, because the way that we would do it is you would get drawn into the, you know, we'd put it, all the girls would pick out a guy to win. It was a whole thing, but I had to organize it each year. And so that's why there was always controversy, because I would have to create like a double elimination bracket.
Okay.
And this is like before we had like computer programs or apps that just do right. that for you.
You're out there with an abacus and a compass and
that's
a,
an elimination bracket. If someone's like, hey, create a double elimination 11 team bracket. I was like, this is going to be complicated. I'm not going to. So there would be controversy in it every year. And it's just one of those things that like, when you play in the tournament and then win the tournament, everyone's like, what kind of Putin nonsense?
Right.
This is like when Putin shows up and scores 11 goals against the Russian national team.
Right, right, right. It's some shenanigans.
Yeah. Some shenanigans. Did you guys have a go-to like yard game with your family?
Yeah, we played played a lot of botch, a lot of bocce ball. You know, it's funny. You know, this is really funny. Actually, when we lived in Washington, because we had like a big, like kind of a big yard, we would play. My mom thought it would be fun to get a croquet. Have you played croquet before? Croquet is actually,
of course, yeah,
mad fun. Anybody croquet wants to talk mess about croquet. Croquet is super fun.
Yeah, and it's a flex if you got a nice yard, because you got to have like short grass and stuff to do that properly, or well, see, go full outdoor style.
We had more of like a fun house yard, because it was like a lot of hit. It was like it wasn't very flat, so you had to play. It was very. It was like mini. It was like mini croquet. Everything was like
extreme.
We put a moat in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everything. We had little bridges. We played some croquet, but mostly bocce ball and like our family tournament now is dominoes. We'll play. We haven't played in a little bit, but we'll play like. We'll play 4 hours like with two different domino sets like people playing against each other, and in the same thing like round robin kind of tournament, 4 hours playing dominoes.
Competitive, like do people get mad?
You know, it's just because we are very competitive, but it's more of like at the end after every game there's like 15 minutes of breakdown where everyone's like, man, okay, remember when you did this and I did that, like what I had in my hand, and like there's like a you talk through so much where it's like, and it's when you lose you feel like you want to
do a post game analysis when like you win, you're like, fans calling
up, like,
in
who cares? Yeah, when you're like shut up, who cares, like I just beat you. But when you lose, it's always like, here's why I lost, you didn't win, here's why I lost. It's like a 15 minute like conversation about that.
Yeah, I get it. Hey, speaking of winning and losing everybody, one way that you can for sure not be a loser is to make sure you guys get some tickets to my Comedy Works streaming show here in 2 weekends from now, everybody. Hey-o. If you guys have not already had a chance, go to dustinnickerson.com/shows. Or, there's a couple ways. You could just go to dustinnickerson.com and hit shows, you know, in the little tab. You know how the internet works. You do. If you listen to a podcast, you know how the internet works.
Yeah.
And those July 31st and August 1st shows are going to be streamed everywhere live, or you can just purchase it and watch within 24 hours. Check that out. And also, we would love if you guys went and checked out our Patreon, patreon.com/don't make me come back, there where you can give a little more to the podcast and get a little more from the podcast. And we're doing a thing, all of our people who are patrons at the end of this month will be getting a free t-shirt in the mail from us. That's in addition to all the bonus content, including the video of this episode with Bob Smiley. Yeah. This bonus content, and in addition to extra pieces of merch, stickers, posters, interview reviews, 5 questions, 10 minutes bonus content, all kinds of fun things from here. Check that out again, patreon.com/don't make me come back there. Guys, enjoy this episode with Bob Smiley, and I hope that your you know, your family summer games aren't too competitive. Just kidding, nobody's seeing their families. All right, enjoy the episode, everybody.
Hey, we'll see you.
Okay, I do want to start out by asking you some Texas. Are you from Texas? Or you just live there now?
No, I'm from Texas. I moved to Nashville the first 5 years that I was doing stand up, but at the time you couldn't buy Bluebell ice cream, and so when I finally got, you know, where I could live anywhere, it was time to, you know, have my loyalty reinstalled. So we moved back to Texas. And, yeah, grew up there, lived there, you know, pretty much all my life.
Okay. What was the Nashville move for? Because I've heard before, you were, didn't you start off doing a lot of stuff with bands?
Yeah, tons of stuff with bands. So the way I got into comedy was I was going to school out in Abilene, Texas, was going to be a teacher, then a principal and a superintendent, like had my whole life mapped out. And then I did one stand-up competition my junior year in college. And the only reason why I did it was the first prize was $500. And that, I don't know if you've been to Abilene, Texas, but that's like 4 months rent. And so I was like, I got to do this. It's easy money. And I, you know, all through my life, people told me I should be a comedian, and I've always loved comedians. My dad would let me stay up and watch Carson if there was a comedian on. Right. So I've always had an appreciation for it, but I never thought that I would do it. But I got up and I did this stand-up competition. I won. Not even because I was good. Everybody else was so terrible. Because it was college kids. The guy who went before me, and I'm sure you've done open mic nights, so you probably have seen, you know, but the guy who went before me had a huge sombrero, and his whole act was going, oh, I shouldn't have sat on the front row. My sombrero might fall on you.
Oh, gosh.
That was like his main thing. So I got up, I did jokes about the zoo, I did jokes about student loans and stuff like that, and I won, and I thought, well, that's great, man. I got, you know, I got a great story to tell my grandkids that, you know, I once won a stand-up competition. Well, 2 years later, I graduated. Before becoming a teacher, I wanted to see what it was like to actually make money, and so I accepted a job as a photographer because I'd been doing photography during the summers for a family friend of ours. And so I was doing photography while I was trying to get, you know, a nest egg stored up so I could teach. And I remember I was driving in Dallas. I was living in Dallas at the time. And this is going to tell you how old I am, but my pager went off.
Yeah.
And I looked at it and it was area code 615. And I didn't know that that was Nashville, but I pulled over to a Cracker Barrel payphone. And I called this. I know. I'm old. Let's get out of the way.
Everything about that sense. I mean, just those two words together: Cracker Barrel payphone.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually what started my career. I called this guy, and he was a friend of mine from college. He had gone out to Nashville and started road managing bands and stuff. And so he was road managing a guy named Clay Cross, and they were getting ready to leave for tour. And Clay said it'd be fun to have a comedian come out. Well, this road manager, he had to hire a merch guy. And so he had seen me do that stand-up competition in college two years ago. And he was like, I got a guy who I think would be good and he'd be clean. So he just called me up. Like, actually, I think the way he got my number is he called the college. And you know how they keep your numbers to ask you for money?
Yeah.
So they just gave him my number, my pager number, which nowadays you couldn't do.
Right.
He called me and he was like, hey, we want to hire you. Really, we want to hire you as a comedian, but we can't pay you. But we have money for a merch guy. Can you come out and do merch? And so I was like, yeah. And I remember standing outside of Cracker Barrel, so flippant, not realizing my life was about to change completely. And I was like, well, how long's the tour? And they were like, I think at the time it was 8 weeks, but there was a possibility to make it longer. And I remember going, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And like hanging up, not realizing. So I got on a plane. I booked a one-way $99 Southwest Airlines flight all the way, fly to Nashville. I got off a plane. I got on a tour bus and went out as a comedian. Yeah. And at that time in my life, I'd done stand-up 3 times in my life, all under a, you know, the longest set was like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So, and then now I'm standing in front of like, you know, 800 people a night, like doing stand up. I would do a merch pitch. I would put all the t-shirts on, and I had jokes that I'd written for all the t-shirts, and like Anointed was one of our opening bands. And so they just had a shirt that had a big A on it. So I'd say, and all this is cheesy, I'm not trying to say that this was good, but this is how I got my start. But yeah. I'd say, hey, Anointed's got a shirt with a big A on it. Some of you college kids, it's your only chance to get an A. You better take it. You know, like,
right. Yeah. And I'm sure it was selling shirts, right?
It was. And people were laughing. And part of me was like, oh, this is easy. Like, you know.
Well, you know, the t-shirt pitch is always an easy laugh.
Yeah, yeah. Now I look back on this and I think I can't believe I got away with this, but I would, you know, as I would take the shirts off, I would pause at one point and go, by the way, I think I'm the only Christian stripper on tour right now. And but with a body like mine, girls usually chant, put it on, you know, stuff like that. But I would do that. I would open with like 5 minutes of comedy, which is basically all the material I'd written. That's all I had.
Yeah.
But what got me, two things happened. What got me kind of seasoned, because I didn't grow up going to open mic nights or testing stuff out or anything. But right. Clay had brought these moving lights, and these moving lights broke almost every single night. So almost every single night, I had to go up and stall. Yeah. And, you know, until they got it fixed. So that's where I learned how to do crowd work. That's how I learned to, you know, when I came into town to find out stuff about the town so I could write some jokes about that and, you right. know, just in case. And yeah, that's how I got my start. And then the Newsboys saw me and they were like, we're getting ready to leave for tour. We want you to come out and do what you did on the Clay Cross tour. We want a merch pitch. We want, you know, 5 minutes of opening. Mainly they wanted me on stage to keep the local people from getting on stage to making all these long announcements and
of course
you know, the whole like, are you guys ready, I can't hear you, like all that stuff. So the Newsboys wanted it was their Take Me to Your Leader tour, which turned out to be the number one tour that year in Christian music. And so again, I'm not a comedian. Like, I'm faking it. But now I'm standing in front of like four. I remember the first time that I ever did a long set was, we were actually in Houston, which is where I live now. But we were in Houston. It was 8,000 people. And it was kind of at the start of the tour. I think we'd done like two or three shows. And the speaker, I think it was Josh McDowell, did not show up on time. Like I think he took a plane in or something. And so anyway, he was delayed. And so they asked me, they came to me and was like, hey, we need you to do 20 minutes tonight.
Yeah.
And I remember just like all of a sudden my shirt just filled with sweat. And I was just like, and I remember looking out of the curtain, you know, and there's 8,000 people there. And I was like, oh my, and I didn't even know if I had 20 minutes of material. I definitely didn't know if it was good. You know, so
if you're not sure if you have 20 minutes, if you do have 20 minutes, it's probably not good.
Yeah. Yeah. You're exactly right. Yeah. I went out there. I tell you, you know, sometimes the comedy gods throw you a bone. And I went out and I had, you know, real poofy red hair at the time. And Conan O'Brien had just like started becoming famous. And I walked out and this guy yelled, Conan O'Brien. And I turned and I was like, come on, man. I don't point out like a famous person you look like. Like, I don't go, hey, Lassie.
Right.
And everybody laughed at that. I know it was mean, but I was so nervous. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. But everybody laughed at that. So then I started doing jokes about myself. And then that became my opening line, because almost every night that I would go on stage, someone would yell Conan.
Yes.
And so then I would do that line, because you know how you get an ad lib and then it becomes part of your show. And so I remember I did that for like 2 weeks. It was like my opening joke. And then one night I walked out on stage and nobody said Conan. And I was like, oh, I didn't know how to get into my act from there. And I was just walking around the stage going, does anybody think I look like someone? Like, I was not seasoned at all.
You're going to have to set a plant.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to get a plant. In there.
Please just yell Conan just about 15 steps in. You know, that's a great story, but honestly, I got distracted at the beginning when you're talking about the competition, and I was just thinking about how much I would love to have a $500 gig right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm planning, I'm working on planning this little backyard tour. And it's amazing, you know, under the circumstances, you know, numbers that you're going like, yeah, I mean, I guess I would do it for that.
it has changed our, because I've been doing this over 20 years and, right. you know, it's selling merch and stuff. I did a free show for the Lions Club in my town 2 weeks ago and just did it for free because I was just dying to get on stage. And they had a big open room where everybody was spread out. And I sold merch and I sold $265, which normally would be kind of a low amount. Right. I have never been more excited about selling that much merch. Like I pulled out the 20s and I was just like, oh, I probably got COVID from rubbing the money on me. But I was like,
the money. Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's totally changed the whole thought process. Like, you know, of how we charge. I'll take anything now. I'm taking everything that I can do.
I was talking to a comedian friend the other day and her and I started around the same time, about 7-8 years ago. You know, or Taylor Tomlinson. And Henning. But I'd be curious your thoughts on this because, you know, I told her, I was like, you know, for you and I, this is our first big comedy tragedy. But for a veteran like yourself, this is not. You know, like, I remember when we had Carrie Pomerelli on, and she told me, actually she was complaining to you once and she quoted you saying like, Carrie, have you never had a bad year before?
Oh yeah.
I think was we get in sometimes in our mindset almost like a normal job where you have, you know, you get hired at a certain amount and that amount will never go down. It might go up, but it'll never go down. You know? But that's not comedy, right? I mean, you've gone through what year did you start?
I started in 96.
Okay, so you went through 9/11 and the stock market crash.
Yeah.
You know, like you've had, which were both, I've heard comics talk long before, like these had huge implications on comedy as well. Is this the same? Is this different? Is this easier? Is this worse? Or is it just more of what you've expected?
Well, even elections, like election time sometimes messes with, you know, churches bringing in, you know, comedy shows and stuff like that. Y2K, like people didn't know what was going to happen to Y2K. Yeah. And so I didn't have any shows booked for the next 3 months, for like January, February, and March, because nobody knew what was going to happen. And I'm sitting at home, I'm mad because I put my VCR again. Man, I'm really letting everybody know how old I am, but I had a VCR, and I programmed it in to be past 2000, and it worked fine. Like, it showed the year. So I was like, okay, if my VCR has the technology to move ahead, I don't think there's going to be any problem. But people were panicked. So, yeah, I mean, I've been through all the rise and fall of it all. This is probably the worst because everything just immediately shut down. Like, all of a sudden, my calendar just was zero. There was just nothing on there, and I didn't know when it was going to end. Now I've actually never had a month that I didn't do shows, but I've never had, if I had a low month, I could always look ahead and go, well, you know, if I can get to October, then I'm going to be fine again. So that, I think that's the biggest panic of all this for us, is that we don't know when it's going to end. Like, we can do stuff, cause I was doing stuff at first to get through it. You know, writing more, like doing some more writing stuff. I write for Focus on the Family. And so I started working on this other book deal that we'd been bouncing around for a while. And so I was finding different ways to bring in money, but I thought, oh, June, we'll be back, you know, to doing this. And now I'm looking and I was like, I don't know if January is going to be.
Well, and every industry is hit, you know, people are like, oh, I like leaned into the pod more. And I was like, yeah, you know, advertisers are hit right now too. They're not like, you know, like we've had sponsors be like, yeah, I'm sorry, we love you, but we can't, you know, we're our business is affected right now too. So it is definitely bigger than comedy. Like that's what I hear. People are like, oh yeah, you know, just write and pitch a show. You're like, you know, they're not making TV right now, right? Everything is on hold right now.
Yeah. And then I tried to get a job, and evidently I am not Walmart worthy. I've never gone this long without doing a show. And two things. One, I'm a father of five boys, and my wife and I were looking at finances and stuff. And so I really have been trying to get a job. So two things. One, I didn't realize how much it messed with my psyche not to be doing shows, because like I said, for 20 plus years, that's all I've been doing. Right. And I remember it was week two of the quarantine, and I was at HEB, had my mask on, pushing my cart. And there were two ladies, because all of a sudden, I think California is the same way, but everybody had to homeschool. Like all of a sudden school shut down. And so everybody was homeschooling, and all these parents are finding out that the teacher was not the problem, that their kid is actually a turd. And so there were these two ladies.
That's hilarious.
These two ladies were in the aisle, and they were complaining about their kid. So they knew each other. And just as I pushed the cart by, all I said was, we sent our kids to our neighbors and had them register as foreign exchange students. They laughed. It was a weird phenomenon of I just stopped the car and just turned, and it was all I could do not to just take the mask off and do like a 30-minute show. I did do about 5 minutes.
You're like,
because I just missed it so much.
You start doing 8 minutes on produce. Why do they organize it like this? Why don't they organize,
I did. I this is embarrassing a little bit, but I did kid material because I read my audience. I knew that that's what they were interested in. And so I really did do about 3 minutes of jokes. But I did it just like I was just talking. And
yeah, I told Melissa, I've been, because I was doing the grocery shopping at the start of quarantine, because everybody voted me most expendable, I guess.
Yeah.
If we can lose anybody, it's Dad. I'm very introverted. The idea of small talk, it causes me distress. Oh gosh, if we talk about going to a party with some, and I was like, is there going to be one person that I really like there and I can just talk to them? But I told her, I was like, this is changing me. Cause I would turn it on with the cash register. I would be riffing. I'd be making jokes. I would be funny. And I was like, it's the human contact, and B, I just need to get some laughs, cause these Zoom shows, I'm not getting them.
Yeah, I saw your Zoom show, and you're right, you're not. I don't even know you that well to say that.
No, it's fine. Comedians are always welcome to make fun of another comedian.
Well, and you started it, because I remember the very first time, because we both were touring with Hawkins, off and on, and
right.
We have a lot of mutual friends. So as I would talk, I would hear your name pop up. But the first time I ever heard you, you were on Tim Hawkins' podcast. And I was at the gym, and I was lifting weights, and I was listening to you, and you said, because you were, talking about starting out, and you said, I had a promoter say to me, you're just as funny as Bob Smiley, but way cheaper.
Yeah.
I was lifting weights, and I was like, what the heck? Oh, it is on now. It is on. So I totally remember that. Nice little dig.
I don't think I'd even seen you at that point. Maybe
no, we had not met.
Yeah, no. But I thought it was a funny sentence.
It was good. I actually, secretly, I liked it. No, we didn't even meet for months. My wife and I went to, we thought it was like a small little life group, but it turned out to be your show. And see, now I can't turn it off. So
it's fine. Hey, I mean, you can insult me all you want, but you were at my show. So.
I was at your show. I was. That is right. Okay, well played. Well played. But no, that was the first time that I met you and stuff. And
Well, what's home life looking like for you right now? Because do you have some folks I don't know. Do you have the boys full time, or do you co-parent with your ex, or how often are the boys around?
Well, so two of my kids, we do normally week on, week off, but okay. During the summers we do a month on, a month off.
Okay.
Those two, my oldest doesn't have a relationship with her. So he's just like, this all went down when he was just starting his junior year, and he kind of knew a lot of stuff that was going on. And so he, he elected, and because he was old enough, he elected to not be a part of her life.
Okay.
It sounds really sad. This is a real downer for a comedy show, but that's this is life. And so,
that's what this podcast is. If you talk family, there's going to be some downer parts.
There is. Yeah. That's what I like about your podcast. Like, you guys are not afraid to shy away from that. But so that's the situation. During the school year, I have, my wife and I, Sarah, we have my two kids week on and week off. And then she has two kids, which kind of a funny story. The first time I ever talked to her on the phone, I was like, how many kids do you have? And she was like, I have two. And I, you know, I'd already been raising three on my own for a pretty long time. Cause for a while I had all three of them until the court, you know, got everything set up. So it was just me and the boys. And so at the time I was like, and this was of course I'd had them for about 3 years on my own, but it's hectic. You know how it is. There's a lot of kid stuff. And I remember she goes, I have two. And I'm kind of embarrassed, but I was like, oh man, I don't know if I want more kids. And at the time she wasn't my wife, but she said the sweetest thing. She was like, two more kids is two more opportunities to love and be loved. And I was like, oh man, that's so good.
Yeah.
And then she was like, how many kids do you have? And I was like, three. And then we got disconnected. So two things happened. One, I love that she went for the joke to just hang up.
Yes. It was so just good.
I was like, okay, that's the one for me. But yeah, so we have five boys. So like July is our month to have my two boys the whole time. So we have four kids living here full time. And then my oldest is in college, but he's here, you know, he was here all day yesterday. So he's here a lot because he goes to college like 25 minutes north of us.
Okay. That is a full busy house.
It is. It is. And the food bill is outrageous. Like, we're hunters. We're big hunters. And so, and my oldest bonus kid, Sarah's oldest kid, Dylan, he loved hunting, but has never had the opportunity to go hunting. And so he got his first deer this last year. It was really cool. Kind of, you know, bonus dad with the kid. It was a great, you know, memory. We were in the deer stand together, and he got his first deer. So I kept that deer separate. So I know for a fact, because I had the way I had it all separated in our refrigerator, the first like week and a half, we ate a deer and a half of just going through every kind of, you know, meat. And our pantry is, there's always a kid in our pantry.
Yeah, that's true. Because we only have the three, but at any given time when I like make the corner around the kitchen, I expect the door to be open and a child's head to be in there, you know, browsing. And the only the way that a child browses, which is like open, head in, you know, and just, it could be anywhere from 5 seconds to 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, of just poking, or do I want that? Or do I want that? I can only imagine five boys. Yeah. It's, I'm surprised they didn't just go eat the deer right when you shot it.
You're right. Well, we will now, because we're not even going to waste time.
Bringing a gun. Just eat it as it's in the wild. Just like an animal.
Chase it down.
Exactly.
We have a walk-in pantry, because you know, I make that kind of money. And one of the hardest times I laughed was we had told our kids, all right, the kitchen's closed. No more food tonight. You've had enough. And I walk in and there's one of my kids is in the pantry and the light's on. And so I just go, and I just see this hand come out of the pantry and just click the light off. Like that was going to fool me. Like nothing to see here. You know,
and in his mind, it was totally going to work.
Oh, yeah. He thought he had fooled me.
It was like brilliant to him. He's like, nope, no. His heart rate didn't even go up. He's like, no, that I have this fully under control.
Yeah.
Well, what are your guys' your days look like then? Are you guys like trying to keep like a structure of activity, or is it just each day Lord of the Flies style? Or like, I'm just curious on how every family is like making the, now that they don't have the structure of school or sports, like how are the days going by?
Yeah, we've done all of that. When it first started with the homeschooling, we were like, everybody's going to be up by 9 o'clock. We're going to have breakfast at 9. We're going to do all the, you know, schoolwork and all that. And then what happened was Sarah and I got into a couple of Netflix specials. And so we were staying up till about 3 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So now our kids are banging on our door going, it's 9:05. We have rules here, you know. And so we were like, well, maybe we'd be a little bit looser. And then as the kids got a handle on all the online schooling and stuff like that, this is horrible, but we sleep till about 10:30. Mm-hmm. And then we all start getting up. We usually have breakfast together, and then everybody's kind of on their own for lunch whenever they want to eat lunch.
Yeah,
we've got stuff that they can all make, you know, sandwiches, corn dogs, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then we have a set dinner time that we do. One of the things that I think we have in common is I play Pokemon Go with my kids.
Yes.
So we have a couple of raids.
We got friends on Pokemon Go. We got to make this happen. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Do you have remote passes?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Oh, so you're for real serious.
Pokemon Go was really brilliant in how they innovated during quarantine. Because this isn't new to our listeners, because I talk about this before, but like you know, Pokemon Go, the whole idea of the game. You and I get to thrive in it because we travel all the time. And so mm-hmm. It's thriving on walking and traveling and going to new places. And so quarantine is the enemy of Pokemon Go. But they were really smart on how they did the remote raid passes, and they just kind of extended your reach and stuff like that. So
I this is terrible. I was doing a show when Pokemon Go had come out, and I got so into it. And like you said, every airport, I'm hitting the Pokestops. I'm yeah. like so into it. And I remember I was doing a show in this old Methodist church, and it was not going well. It was a bunch of elderly people that they're just there because the church doors are open.
Yeah.
So they're not really coming to see me.
Right.
And it was just, it was not good. And so I set my phone on the podium up there. And just every once in a while, there was a Pokestop. So every once in a while, I just walk by and just spin it. And then this is if people are listening to me that have the potential to bring me in for a show. This was back when I didn't know any better. I promise I'm professional now. But yeah. I caught a Charmander in the middle of my show. Like one popped up, and I was like, "No way!" And so I'm sitting there. It's a big Methodist, you know, podium.
Yeah.
So they can't see that I'm sitting there throwing the Pokeball.
They know you're going through your notes.
Yeah,
exactly. That's exactly.
Not giving him a pin app. Yeah.
Oh man, I've definitely. That's one of those. There are gigs that you're just bored up there. Mm-hmm. You're like, it's not. It's you bombed enough where you know, like, it hurts my feelings, sure, but I know what a bomb is. Yeah. I've done enough bad gigs. I've gotten through this. And a crowd like that, that's just a bomb. That's not like, they're not hostile towards you. You just got to get through it. And you're just like, all right, well, I'll do it. I found myself just doing my act and having whole different thoughts. Like, I'm just like, I wonder if that Panera Bread's open still. Yeah. Like, I wonder where I'm going to go after this, you know, and being like, I'm definitely not going to pitch my merch because none of those are going to sell. You know, it's amazing how your brain can just like categorize and just be like, all right, I'm done with this.
I remember I did a show one time, and I made a grocery list in my mind for when I landed to the next day. Cause I was like, oh man, we need groceries. And so I'm up there and I'm just on automatic pilot, just like you said. And it wasn't that they weren't enjoying it. They were, but it just wasn't this electrifying show where I was enjoying it.
Right.
So the probably one of the worst shows, it was right after my wife had left and all this information had come out. So I was really depressed. And I had agreed to do a fundraiser for an orphanage on New Year's Eve. So already I'm alone. It's New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
I'm depressed. I agreed to do it for like half my price. To cut them a deal. And then I could sleep. They put me up in this hotel because it was at this little hotel resort place, and they had a big casino, and that was their, and they do it every year. So all these rich, and it was in the Woodlands where I live. And so all these rich people come to this casino every single year and they spend tons of money. They give away a car. So it's like a big deal. So I get there, but and already I just don't like they're in, you know, tuxes and everybody's, you know, it's everything that's bad for comedy.
Yeah.
And they were, it was like 800 people in this it fit 800 people in the room. So it was totally packed and we had dinner. And then the lady gets up and she's like, all right, now for the moment you've all been waiting for, the casino is open. Or if you want to stay in here, we got a guy that's going to tell some jokes.
Yeah. So
everybody except for 17 people left. And about, I think it was 12 people were all at one round table. And the only reason why they stayed is because they had ordered a bottle of wine and they wanted to finish the wine. So I get up and I'm already super, you know, like just, this is just horrible. I'm in a room that holds 800 and there's 17 people. And then the people that are finishing their wine, they're talking. So they're being loud. So then the lady that was in charge of the event goes over and tells them to be quiet. So they get up and leave. So now I've got like five people left in the room.
Oh my gosh.
So I tell you that because in the middle of the show, my son Trent called me and I took the call. I'd never done that before, but I was like, hey, what's up? And he was like, hey dad, how's the show going? And I was like, I'm in the middle of it. And he goes, oh, sorry, I'll let you go. And I was like, no, what's going on? And the five people thought it was funny because they knew, they knew how bad it was.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that, like, people ask a lot of questions about being a comedian, and they're usually to do with hecklers and where do you come up with your material and all the dumb questions that we hear over and over and over and over. But one of the real things that, like, doesn't get talked about a lot is, like, we have to perform no matter what state we're in emotionally. Now, physically, sometimes I've had one sick day ever, and it was because I was supposed to be in Florida and I couldn't get out of bed. Like, I was like, I can't. I'm incapable of traveling there. I don't have the, and I've had one sick day in the 8 years. But emotionally, I've been real sick.
Yeah.
So but you just gotta go and do it. And sometimes it's cathartic and like very helpful. And other times you're like, yeah, I think this just made it worse.
Yeah. I remember right after the divorce and, again, you know, everything was, I didn't even know if I'd still have a career because I didn't know if churches were going to hire me, even though it wasn't my choice or anything.
It's so weird. So because you're, you know, we both do churches and you know, when you are like firmly planted in the faith space, you know, you get treated like, and I think this is to a degree for me, though maybe slightly less so, but like, but it's still there, absolutely, of like, you're expected to be a pastor, you know, like they hold you, and really you're expected to be Jesus is what they really expect,
right.
You know, like, so that's, yeah, you're not just going through a divorce and, you know, the hardship of ending a marriage, our church is going to be afraid to book me because now I'm a sinner or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's just an added level of emotional pain, I would imagine, complexity and uncertainty, I imagine.
Yeah, and so I went out that week and was on stage and doing a show, and I remember they're all laughing, and it was very much so, you know, the clown that's crying on the inside. And I remember standing on stage and I told this big, you know, punchline, got a huge laugh, got an applause break. And I remember standing there thinking, why are you laughing? Do you not realize how much pain there is in the world? Like, I'm thinking this in my mind. I was resenting the laughs that I was getting. I was like, how can you guys be so flippant and carefree? And then I came to my senses and I was like, nobody knows, you know, what's going on with me
or right.
anything. And, you know, because I wasn't going to hide it, but I wasn't planning on talking about it. And
right.
I was really thinking that churches, you know, so when I was staying on stage that night, I was thinking that, you know, I think I had maybe 10 more shows booked, but even then I was thinking, I really need to get my mind right and enjoy this because, you know, I may not be doing this in a couple months.
Right. Yeah. I wish I would have been thinking that, when rumors of coronavirus started,
yeah.
I keep thinking about the last gig that I had done. I was like, ah, man, I wouldn't have done that much crowd work if I would have known that was going to be my last gig ever. I've done some intermittent stuff here and there, but
yeah, this is how much I miss it. I will go back and watch my Dry Bar comedy special and just sit and just be like, oh my goodness, I remember when I used to be able to do that.
Yeah.
are you worried? I know you have shows, like you have some shows coming. Have you done your Denver one yet?
That's 2 weekends from now, yeah.
Okay. So are you worried about being rusty or?
So I did some shows in June, and I did 2 weekends in June, one here in San Diego and then one up in Tacoma. Somebody said this like early on, and I've kind of like grasped to it. Like, you know, like if you can get something, take it, because you don't, it's going to come and go. And I was very wrong about, I remember saying like, no, once we reopen, it won't shut down again. And man, was I wrong about that.
Yeah.
And I think it might be like this for a while. So yes, it's very spread out. I haven't been on stage since the last weekend of, or I guess mid-June. So it's been about 3 weeks, which is an eternity in comedy.
Right.
Right. I mean, Pete Holmes said, right, comedy is the only art form you can forget how to do in a week.
And yeah, that's right.
So I watched old sets, and I'm going to go back and watch old sets, not to be inspired about comedy, but just remember how my act goes. Like, yeah. I was saying, when I went into Tacoma, and I don't have a ton of fans, but I have a good chunk there in the Northwest, and I remember saying to them on stage, like, some of you are going to know these jokes better than me. If you hear me just forget a part, feel free to shout that out. Feel free. Like, and I would get to the rhythm of the joke, because – you know, jokes are very musical to comedians. There's a certain rhythm to how they go. And then I would just be like, I don't know the next part. I don't know. I know it's not done, but I'm not. So yes, I'm very worried about being rusty. I would imagine you are too, whenever it comes back.
Yeah, I didn't. So my last show was in March, but then in July, I had, like I said, I had that Lions Club one. And then I did, but that one was just like a 30-minute deal. But then I did a youth camp that they actually still had camp. And so and it was in Texas.
Yeah, I did one in Texas too, yeah.
Okay, well, so I did that just a couple weeks ago, but it was like an hour, 15-minute set.
Whoa.
And so I really did have to go back, like you said, and watch footage. And I couldn't believe how much stuff I'd forgotten, you know, and even – even on stage, I was in the middle of telling like a joke, and there was one church group of kids there that had seen me previously, like in January, so real recent. And I left off a tagline, and one of the kids yelled out the tagline, and I was like, oh yeah. And I wanted to say, do you want to get up and do my act? But I was afraid he would.
And be better. Yeah.
And be better. Yeah.
Get off. Yeah. That's, it's funny you mentioned that. I was thinking this earlier, like, the way you came up in concert environments, you know, like I've done, I think almost every kind of gig there is. And my come up was more club open mics.
Mm-hmm.
And I know like there's sometimes like that, like, oh, what the differential, but I will tell you that club open mics, as hard as they are 1,000 times easier than a concert environment, because there's no one there to bomb for usually. That's what an open mic is. It's just like two or three drunks and a bunch of comics in the back. So you don't know if your material's working, and it can feel like treading water and da 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 da. But I'll tell you, man, like I'll take that over someone doing a sound check behind me.
Yeah.
I'll take that over just like I did a festival, a music festival up in the Portland area a couple years ago, and like they didn't tell the roadies that they weren't supposed to sound check. I they started hitting the drums during my set, and I looked back at them. I go, guys, I'm on the poster. I'm not up here filling time. And they're like, you know, like the roadies are just like, whatever. I don't think roadies could not care less about talent, you know, talent or whatever, you know. And it's just, but like, I will take a quiet room over a loud outdoor sprawling, because even when you're doing well, you don't know it. You can't hear. You can have 5,000 people, and if they're outside, you can't hear that laugh. You
know? Yeah. For three years, I did this tour called Festival Con Dios, and it was 11 Christian bands, and we traveled, and we brought our own stage and all our stuff, and so we would set up in mall parking lots or, you know, fields and stuff like that, and my job was to do stand up in between each act of 11 acts. And so sometimes at the beginning, I would have 5 minutes between like the first five bands. And then as you know, we got to like the three big headliners, then I would have longer sets.
Right.
But it started usually about 1 o'clock in the, you know, afternoon in the boiling heat.
Yeah.
And it was, and they wanted 5 minutes, but just 5 minutes between each act, because they would reset the stage. They would do a quick sound check while I'm doing it. So many times I'm up there for 3 years going, hey, waka, waka, waka. And I'm, I'm just sitting there. I'm like, and it's, so I learned, and this has helped me when I do Zoom comedy shows now, I learned to just look for people laughing, because you couldn't hear. So I would just learn to look at their faces. And now I'm doing Zoom comedy shows, and, you know, they mute everybody.
Right.
And so
right.
Now I'm just looking up, and I'm seeing people going, you know, like laughing, but you can't hear anything. And I'm like, I'm back to my Festival Con Dios days. I toured with this band called the Supertones.
Oh, yeah.
OC Supertones. They, when ska hit, they were selling out venues. And so they brought me out on tour, and man, you talk about tough crowds.
Yeah.
You get in a warehouse with no chairs, and you pack 800 kids in there.
Yeah.
And they're all chanting Supertones, Supertones. And they're like, hey guys, first of all, we have a guy that wants to make you laugh.
Yeah.
You know? And,
and your name too, like that kind of crowd, it's both of it. First off, they hear Bob, and they're like, what, a Bob? Yeah. And then Smiley, and so it sounds like a stage name.
Right.
Bob Smiley sounds like a cheesy Christian stage name.
Yeah. It does.
So they are as skeptical as possible when you walk in on that stage.
And I learned stuff, like I shouldn't have worn the three-piece suit, and, you know, I learned some things. I took my pager off, so they didn't make fun of that. You know, you learn as you go.
You know what? This conversation is helping me with the thing that I talk to my children about the very most, which is gratefulness. And when you play bad crowds, and part of the reason that I heard a comedian, Alonzo Bowden, say this. He goes, you know, when you first started, all you ever wanted to do was perform on the weekends. Mm-hmm. And that mindset is so true. You're like, man, I just want to do the weekends. I want to get out of open mics, and I want to get to the book shows. I want to do the weekends with the real crowds. And it's the same thing, you know, like so when you do have a good crowd, wherever it is, or it's your people, or it's just a hot crowd in general, it makes you grateful. And I was texting again, I was talking to Tomlinson about this. I was just saying, like, when we do start touring for real again, and not just touring, but touring with full capacity crowds, mm-hmm. and, you know, we will be so much more grateful, you know, because we had our things taken away, you know?
Yeah. I remember being at a festival, and I was on a bus with the headliner, and there was an opening band that came in that they were going to play about 3 o'clock. And so we were just kind of hanging out and everything. And the opening band was like, oh man, I can't wait till we get to the headlining position. And the headliner looked at him and said, I'll swap positions with you right now if you want to, because then I can play my show at 3 and I can be done.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, oh, I don't want to ever get like that. Like, yeah. I want to appreciate
Sorry, the loudest car in history just went by. Go ahead.
I thought that was your stomach. I was like, okay, we're going to have to cut this short. But I remember like, yeah, I need to be grateful. And so, and thankfully that happened kind of early in my career. And so yeah. I've like tried to keep that, but you know how it is. You're doing your eighth show for the week and you know, you're just going out there. It's hard not to just go out and just crank it out and just, you
know,
look at the clock. And Clay's okay with me telling the story, but when I was touring the first year with Clay Cross, his big song was I Surrender All. And so he would close with that. And so we were doing this one event where the promoter wanted an hour and a half show.
Yeah.
And this was after the tour had ended. So Clay just took me out just to open. And so we were like, we got to do an hour and a half show. And Clay normally did about an hour. And so I did an extra long set. He did a couple more songs. And at the end, he's singing I Surrender All. And he hit the big note. I won't do it because I can't sing. But he was like, I surrender all. And then he just held it. And as he said all, he put his arm up, you know, to emphasize, you know, all, you know, hand to heaven. And then he turned his wrist over to look at his watch. I was like, Clay. You can't do that, man.
That's part of the reason I never wear a watch on stage. I've seen people do that, and there's just nothing more insulting if you catch it. You're like, oh, my gosh, this guy's tuned out.
Yeah, he didn't want to be here. Okay, so here's a little – here's what I do. I'm just going to go ahead and give this trick. I'm going to give away my secret, but I wear my watch up like on the inside of my wrist. Yeah. Because I usually use a Countryman. I don't use a handheld. Mm-hmm. But even if I do, I use my hands a lot. So my hands are always kind of out in front of me.
Right.
And, you know, and I kind of palms up. So I can always just look down and see my watch. Because I'm like you. I've seen so many comedians that, you know, they're just looking to fill their 45-minute slot. And they're, you know.
Whatever it takes, man. I don't like having to look at the time. I put a timer on the stool because literally the only thing on my rider is like a stool, and it's amazing how many people get that wrong. Like a flat, you know, bar stool. So I just put notes, a water, my phone there, and yeah. And on those bad gigs, you're like, oh gosh, 38 minutes left.
Yeah,
yeah. I will say this, and this is a good place I think to end the one of my best friends in comedy is a guy named Zoltan Cassis, and he said we were going in and we were doing a comedy club in Kirkland, Washington called Laughs, and I was middling for him, and we walked in and I looked at the marquee and I was like, oh man, there you go, man, big time headliner. And he goes, you know, you want to know what it feels like to be the headliner as opposed to the feature? And I go, how? And he goes, the same. and it is exactly right. And if anything, it's worse because there's more pressure.
There's more pressure. That,
yeah, now when it's a bad crowd and you're middling, you're like, oh, thank God. All right, man. Well, I appreciate you making time for this. Be well. Say hi to the family for me and survive that Houston humidity as best as you can.
Yeah, and I want to get you on our podcast.
So man.
I'm not trying to promote it on your podcast, Hook, Line, and Smiley, but you know, I would like to get you on my Hook, Line, and Smiley podcast if I can.
Absolutely. We'll mention that in the intro too.
Okay.
All right. Take care. Thanks, Bob.
All right, we'll see you, bud. Bye.
Thanks for listening to that episode, everybody. I wanted to give a special shout out to our designated drivers. That is our highest level of patrons. Demarius Diaz-Stevens, Troy Meacham, Dave Hoagland, and Rachel Jakewith. Really appreciate your support of the podcast. If you have not already, please like and subscribe and share. Backseaters, you mean the world to us. Thanks so much for tuning in.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.